welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for November the 7th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, Biden on Cusp of Victory. Democrat Joe Biden stood on the cusp of winning the presidency Friday night, 3 days after the election, as the long, exacting work of counting votes widened his lead over President Donald Trump in critical battleground states. High turnout, a massive number of mail-in ballots, and slim margins between the two candidates all contributed to the delay in naming a winner. But Biden held leads in Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Georgia, putting him in an ever stronger position to capture the 270 Electoral College votes needed to take the White House. There was intense focus on Pennsylvania, where Biden led Trump by more than 27,000 votes, and Nevada, where the Democrat led by about 22,000. The prolonged wait added to the anxiety of a nation facing historic challenges, including the surging pandemic and deep political polarization. Biden said Friday he is already preparing to assume the presidency, even though he has not been declared the winner. "I want people to know we're not waiting to get the work done," he said late Friday in remarks to the nation. Biden said he and his running mate, Kamala Harris, have held briefings on the coronavirus and the economy this week, as the U.S. is seeing record numbers of daily cases. He noted nearly 240,000 people have died from the pandemic, and said he wants those families to know they aren't alone. He also addressed the millions of Americans who remained out of work and are struggling to pay for rent or buy food. "We don't have any more time to waste on partisan warfare," he said. Trump stayed in the White House and out of sight Friday as more results trickled in and expanded Biden's lead in must-win Pennsylvania. Trump's campaign on Friday was mostly quiet, a dramatic difference from the day before when officials held a morning call projecting confidence and then a flurry of press conferences announcing litigation as in key states. But it was touched once again by the coronavirus pandemic. Chief of Staff Mark Meadows contracted the virus, according to the two senior White House officials not authorized to publicly discuss private matters. Several other members of the White House staff and Trump's campaign team also tested positive. Trump's handling of the pandemic has been the defining issue of the campaign. The president, the First Lady Melania Trump, and several other people in Trump's orbit have fallen ill. A handful of states remained in play Friday evening: Georgia, North Carolina, too early to call along with Pennsylvania and Nevada. In all four states, the margins between Trump and Biden were too narrow and the number of ballots left to be counted too great for the AP to declare a victor. In Pennsylvania, officials were not allowed to begin processing mail-in ballots until Election Day under state law. In Nevada, there were a number of provisional ballots cast by voters who registered on Election Day, and officials had to verify their eligibility, and recounts could be triggered in both Pennsylvania and Georgia. With his pathway to re-election appearing to greatly narrow, Trump was testing how far he could go in using the trapping of presidential power to undermine confidence in the vote. On Thursday, he advanced unsupported accusations of voter fraud to falsely argue that his rival was trying to seize power. "It was an extraordinary effort by a sitting American president to sow doubt in the democratic process. This is a case where they are trying to steal an election. They are trying to rig an election," Trump said from the podium of the White House briefing room. He took to Twitter late Friday to pledge further legal action, tweeting that Joe Biden should not wrongfully claim the office of the president. "I could make that claim also. Legal proceedings are just now beginning." Trump did claim that he won late on election night. He also tweeted that he had such a big lead in all of these states late into election night, only to see the leads miraculously disappear as days went by, although it was well known that votes cast before Tuesday were still being legally counted. Trump's erroneous claims about the integrity of the election challenged Republicans now faced with the choice of whether to break with a president who, though his grip on his office grew tenuous, commanded sky-high approval ratings from rank-and-file members of the GOP. That was especially true for those who are eyeing presidential runs of their own in 2024. Maryland GOP Governor Larry Hogan, a potential presidential hopeful who has often criticized Trump, said unequivocally, "There is no defense for the president's comments tonight undermining our democratic process. America is counting the votes, and we must respect the results as we always have done before." But others, who are rumored to be considering a White House run of their own in 4 years, align themselves with the incumbent, including Senator Josh Hawley, RMO, who tweeted support for Trump's claim, writing that, "If the last 24 hours have made anything clear, it's that we need new election integrity laws now." Trump's campaign engaged in a flurry of legal activity, saying it would seek a recount in Wisconsin and had filed lawsuits in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Georgia. Let's now move on to the article, "We're Sticking to Our Plan, Mason City Schools to Continue with In-Person Learning." The COVID-19 numbers in Cerro Gordo County and statewide haven't been good as of late. In Cerro Gordo County alone, the 14-day rolling average of positive tests sit at 18.9% as of Friday. In fact, there are only 24 out of 99 counties in the state that have a positive percentage under 15%. On October 30th, Mason City Schools reported its highest amount of COVID-19 cases up to that point in the weekly report, and followed it up by reporting even higher numbers on Friday morning. The district had 13 student cases reported this week, 10 staff cases, and 118 students in quarantine. When you look at the number of positive individuals from that 14-day average on October 13th, we had 108 people. On that 14-day rolling average, October 30th, we had 371, the director of Cerro Gordo County Public Health, Brian Hanft, said about the county's cases at the Board of Education meeting on Monday. "We're up three times from where we were. Despite this, the absentee callouts related to COVID-19 remain relatively low for Mason City. In a district of 3,300 students, to only have 25 student cases over the last 2 weeks is less than 1% of the district. We're sticking to our plan," Versteeg said at the board meeting. "The conversation will be whether we should or not change the plan when the community transmission rate is between 15% and 20%, and student absenteeism in the building related to COVID-19 is between 10% and 15%. Those are the guidelines for the waiver in our state." Versteeg said Mason City tracks students' absenteeism by building, not necessarily by the district as a whole, meaning that if a building were to have a high absentee percentage, administration would apply for the two-week continuous learning waiver only for that building, not school-wide. To give you an example, our high school has the most cases usually, not only total but percent-wise, Versteeg said Friday, October 30th. "Their COVID absent rate was 2.9%, so not even close. Was it up a little bit? It was up a little bit, but not to that level where you would think that, oh, we're ready to do something." Versteeg brought Hanft to Monday's board meeting to talk about COVID-19 in the community and how it relates to schools. "Over the last few weeks, Mason City has slowly started to trickle students back to a four-day in-person school week. The only building that hasn't returned to a four-day in-person learning is Lincoln Intermediate. These students will return on Monday. As we start to look at the increasing numbers in the community, I don't want to correlate that to the increasing number of kids in school," Hamst said. Hamst went to say that schools in Cerro Gordo County have done a good job of keeping COVID-19 numbers low in their respective districts. "The Mason City numbers, I saw them today, and I didn't look at them that close, but they're not out of the norm," Hamft said. "What is out of the norm is what we're seeing out in the community." Hamft took on the microphone to reiterate using mitigation strategies like sanitizing often and staying home if you're feeling sick. One specific strategy was extra important. "We have got to own this in a way that is being facilitated across the state. And that is asking every single person to wear their masks," Hamft said. "Take personal responsibility in that. For now, the Mason City Community School District is sticking to the four-day in-person learning plan. Both Versteeg and Hamft hope that the community can be as responsible as they say members of the school district are in the classroom. Now onto the article, Faith Lutheran Home in Osage Ravaged by COVID-19. The coronavirus continues to hit home in Osage. At Faith Lutheran Home, within the past month, life has completely changed for its residents. Administrator Hunter Lauritsen says the epidemic is spreading like wildfire. On this day, he cannot even recall exactly how many people have died. He provides an estimate of 12. That is around 25% of the total population of the home. Every resident has tested positive for COVID-19. Most of the clinical staff have it as well. Most, however, have been cleared to return to work. The home is a 60-bed facility, and before the spread of the virus, there were 49 people living there. Now, there are only 35. It's not what we'd like to see happen, Lauritsen said. When you're dealing with the frail and elderly population, they don't do very well when they get the disease. The first case in Faith Lutheran, a staff member, was October 8th. A few days later, the first resident contracted it. 3 weeks later, the first person died. When you're in a space like housing, where everyone is close together, it's hard to control. Also, two residents and one staff member have ended up in ICU. It's not just the elderly, Lauritsen said. The worker was in his 50s. This experience has been a very trying time, Lauritsen said. But the community support that we've received, the support from the families, the understanding of our residents, and the care from our staff has really helped us keep going. This is a very special place here. It's unfortunate this is happening. The community has come together to make sure we have everything we need to prevent and control this as much as possible. Lauritsen has watched friends die. There are several who have been here for a long time. Some had been here longer than I have, Lauritsen said, who has worked at Faith Lutheran since 2018. It's been very hard. There have been sleepless nights and taxing situations. I stay hopeful. Sometimes that's all we can do. It's going to be hard, when this is all over, to go back to normal. Having served on the front lines, Lauritsen said that he has no patience for those who refuse to wear masks. I would say to think about the impact it has on those around you, he said. I know it's very frustrating for people to wear a mask for over 7 months now, but one little slip-up can cost people their lives. Be vigilant. This disease is horrific. Now let's go to the article, Trump Wins White Evangelicals, Catholics Split. President Donald Trump won support from about 8 in 10 white evangelical Christian voters in his race for re-election, but Catholic voters split almost evenly between him and Democratic opponent Joe Biden, according to the AP VoteCast. Trump's stronghold on white evangelical voters illustrates the GOP's enduring success with a bloc of religious conservatives who have been a linchpin of the president's political base since his 2016 victory. The president's path to a second term has grown narrower, however, amid a divide among Catholics between Trump and Biden, a lifelong member of the faith. AP VoteCast showed 50% of Catholics backing Trump and 49% favoring Biden, reflecting the faith's long-standing role as a closely contested vote in the presidential elections, particularly in Rust Belt battleground states such as Michigan and Wisconsin. Trump won both of these states by less than 1% point in 2016, but Biden prevailed in both this year. The survey of more than 110,000 voters nationwide was conducted for the Associated Press by NORC at the University of Chicago. Ahead of the election, the rival campaigns targeted Catholics with fervent appeals to vote based on their faith. Trump supporters said faithful Catholics should not vote for Biden because of his support for abortion rights, while Biden backers said Trump is too divisive, and has failed to elevate social justice issues that are a key part of Catholic teaching. Michael Ware, a past faith advisor to former President Barack Obama, said he saw signs that the Biden campaign's focused outreach to religious voters, which included multiple ads invoking the former vice president's Catholicism, has paid off. Biden would be just the second Catholic president after John F. Kennedy. Biden's political approach has been vindicated in these results, said Ware, who helped lead a bipartisan super PAC this fall that aimed to undercut Trump's Christian support. He ran because he believed he would not lose the Rust Belt, which the nominee in 2016 did. Michael New, an abortion opponent who teaches social research at Catholic University of America, said Trump's opposition to abortion likely attracted some Catholic voters even if they disagreed with him on other issues. This year, Catholic voters accounted for 22% of the electorate, and there was a sharp rift within their ranks by race and ethnicity. Among white Catholics, 57% backed Trump and 42% backed Biden, according to VoteCast. In 2016, Trump won by 64% of white Catholics. Trump won 64% of white Catholics, and Clinton won 31%, according to Pew Research Center analysis of voters. Among Hispanic Catholics, VoteCast showed 67% backed Biden and 32% backed Trump. The election results show that the Catholic Church is as divided as our nation, but the real divide is race and ethnicity, not theology, said David Gibson, the director of Fordham University's Center on Religion and Culture. He said the gap between the white Catholic vote for Trump and the Latino vote for Biden poses a challenge for church leaders, especially if the Republican Party continues to woo white voters with anti-immigrant rhetoric. If the Republican Party continues to try and amplify calls to white grievance and fear of immigrants in order to rally the white Catholic vote, that could create further problems for the Catholic Church itself as it seeks unity, Gibson said via email. Catholics weren't the only religious group vocally courted by the Biden campaign, which also sought to cut into Trump's advantage with certain segments of the white evangelical electorate. Yet the president's commanding performance with that bloc raises questions about whether future Democratic campaigns would make similar efforts. Ryan Burge, a political scientist at Eastern Illinois University who focuses on religious voting patterns, said white evangelicals are as red can get, and suggested that future Democrats' hopefuls pay more attention to white Catholics and Hispanic evangelicals. There's no way to peel anybody off because there's no wedge there among white evangelicals who favor the Republican agenda, Birch said. Among voters with no religious affiliation, Biden took 72% while Trump took 26%. And VoteCast found several other religious voting blocs going overwhelmingly for Biden, largely in line with their previous preference for Democrats. Jewish voters made up 3% of the electorate and went overwhelmingly for Biden, with 68% backing the Democrat compared with 30% backing Trump. Among Muslim voters, 64% supported Biden and 35% supported Trump. In 2016, a survey from the Pew Research Center, about two-thirds of U.S. Muslims identified as Democratic or leaned to the Democratic Party. One bright spot for Trump among religious voters was his performance with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints members. In 2016, Trump won the state of Utah with its sizable population of church members, with less than 50% support as a third-party candidate. Evan McMillan, a church member himself, won more than 20% of the vote. While 67% of members of the faith voted for Republicans in the 2018 midterms, according to VoteCast, only 56% said that they approved of Trump's handling of his job. But this year, with no third-party candidate on the ballot, Trump got the backing of 71% of Latter-day Saints nationwide, while 24% supported Biden. Now let's move on to the article, Unemployment Rate Goes Down. Figure falls to 6.9%. Employers in the U.S. add 638,000 positions. Defying fears of another slowdown, U.S. businesses kept hiring at a solid pace in October, yet there are signs that remain cautious about the economy's future as the pandemic worsens. The Labor Department said Friday that employers added 638,000 jobs and the unemployment rate has tumbled a full percentage point to 6.9, extending what has been a faster recovery than many economists expected in the spring. But the pace of hiring isn't robust enough to rapidly soak up the millions of Americans who were thrown out of work by the pandemic recession. The job gains were little changed from September's 672,000 and less than half of August's 1.5 million. but the increase was stronger than it appeared. It was held down by the loss of 150,000 temporary census jobs. Excluding governments at all levels, private businesses added a healthy 906,000 jobs. That figure has held steady for 3 months. Overall, the latest jobs report suggests that tentative recovery remains intact for now, and that the economy is continuing to adapt to the pandemic. It was a pleasant surprise to see that the pace of the recovery hasn't slowed down, said Nick Bunker, an economist at Indeed, the job search website. But we all need to keep in mind that the huge hole that we're in terms of jobs and unemployment. Hiring rose in retail, including in online retail, where many Americans have turned during the viral outbreak. Warehousing and courier services have both added jobs in every month since the pandemic, including last month. Meanwhile, virus pressure mounting at French nursing homes, where more than 400 people with COVID-19 have died in the past week, and some residents are again being confined to their rooms and being cut off from their families. French Health Minister Olivier Véran said Friday that the government is sending 1.6 million rapid virus tests to care homes across the country to allow them to test personnel. It's part of efforts to avoid mass new confinement of nursing home residents. In other developments, the U.S. Department of Defense deployed 3 Air Force medical teams to El Paso on Friday to help fight the surging coronavirus in the region, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said. Luxury fashion boutiques, jewelry shops, and most of Milan's flagship department stores were shuttered Friday as the center of Italy's vibrant financial capital fell into a gray quiet on the first day of a partial lockdown in 4 regions. And now on to the article, recount of 19,000 ballots ordered in tight Iowa 2nd District U.S. House election. More than 19,000 ballots will be recounted, including nearly 600 by hand, in one precinct in Iowa's still-too-close-to-call 2nd Congressional District election after local officials discovered an error in the reporting of Tuesday's results. Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate ordered the recounts Friday after Jasper County Auditor Dennis Parrott notified the state of a human error that resulted in an inaccurate count of the 591 Election Day ballots cast a single precinct in Mingo. The state has already adjusted the votes in its unofficial count, and the update changed the leader in 2nd District. Republican Marionette Miller Meeks had been ahead by 282 votes, but after the adjustment due to the Jasper County error, Democrat Rita Hart now leads by 162 votes. Those results remain unofficial and could still change with the pending recounts and the potential addition of absentee ballots that were postmarked before Election Day but have not yet been received by county auditors. The Associated Press has not called the race. The state will certify the election results next week, and depending on how close the 2nd District results remain, either campaign could request another recount. I'm asking for an audit and a recount, and we'll wait and see how those show. That's all a part of this process, Pate said Friday during a news conference at the Jasper County Courthouse. Parrott said the reporting error was made when transferring vote totals to a spreadsheet. He said it was purely human error, not the result of faulty equipment or malicious political intent. He said his office noticed the error Thursday and notified the Secretary of State's office. Even though the error was confined to one precinct in Mingo, Pate has requested a recount for the entire county, and Parrott and the entire Board of Supervisors has agreed. "I'm interested in getting this right for Jasper County," Parrott said. Parrott and Pate both credited the checks and balances built into the system for their ability to catch the error and fix it before the results became official. But the Miller Meeks campaign issued a statement later Friday raising concerns with the process. "We do not agree with the Jasper County Auditor and the Secretary of State's office that there has been sufficient transparency concerning the machine irregularities in the auditor's own claims that human error in the tabulation process arose after results were reported." A statement from the Miller Meeks campaign said, We have demanded additional information because those unexplained discrepancies have the potential to alter the election outcome. We expect to receive that information immediately. Rita Hart's campaign said it supports the action of the Secretary of State and Jasper County Auditor to ensure all results are accurate. As we have said consistently, Iowans' voices must be heard and their voices accurately counted. Rita Hart of Iowa campaign manager Zach Moyner said in a statement, "It is thus critical that county auditors ensure all results are accurate. We understand that county auditors of Jasper County is undertaking an administrative review to ensure that vote totals from the county, which have been verified by Iowa Republican Secretary of State Paul Peet and Jasper County Auditor, and which show Rita Hart leading by 162 votes, are accurate. We are confident by the end of this process that Rita Hart will be the next Congresswoman for Iowa 2nd District." In the newly adjusted but still unofficial results as of Friday afternoon, Hart had 196,603 votes, and Miller Meeks had 196,441. Just a 0.04% difference separated them. At the Mingo precinct where the error occurred, in the newly adjusted but still unofficial results as of Friday afternoon, Miller Meeks had 620 votes and Hart had 380. Election night results are always unofficial. The numbers are not finalized until after counties conduct post-election audits and canvasses, and the numbers are certified on a statewide basis at the end of November. As of Thursday morning, more than 12,300 outstanding absentee ballots sent to voters in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Scott, Clinton, Muscatine, and Louisa counties, had yet to be received by county auditors. Any of those ballots that were postmarked before Election Day and are received by auditors by Monday will still be counted in the results. The hand count audit of the precinct in question and the countywide administrative recount will begin immediately and be completed ahead of the Jasper County canvass of votes on Tuesday afternoon, according to the Secretary of State's office. County election boards will convene Monday and Tuesday for the official canvass of votes in each county. Campaigns then have until 5 p.m. on Friday, November 13th, to request a recount. Now for the article, Guns Seen Outside Vote Counting Centers. The most turbulent and norm-breaking presidential election of a lifetime has led to an extraordinary spectacle in the United States over the past 3 days. Armed protesters gathering nightly outside offices where local workers are counting the votes that will decide who wins the White House. Some carry shotguns, some have handguns, often they carry black military-style semi-automatic rifles. The protesters with weapons are a small minority of the demonstrators. There have been no reports of anyone getting shot, and the laws in Arizona and Michigan, where guns have been seen outside of vote tabulation centers, allow people to openly carry firearms in public. But in a nation increasingly inured to weapons at rallies, most often carried by right-wing demonstrators, though also sometimes by left-wing protesters, experts warn that guns create a dangerous situation that could be seen as intimidation or tip easily into violence. The more we see, the more people see it as a normal reaction, even though it's not. There's nothing normal about it, said Cynthia Miller Idris, a professor at American University who studies extremism. The potential for violence becomes normalized. The armed protesters have shown up at the vote counting centers in response to the groundless accusations from President Donald Trump that the Democrats are trying to steal the election. No serious irregularities have been reported. Elections officials in several states where Democrat Joe Biden was ahead said the anger outside their doors made them fear for the safety of their employees. About 100 Trump supporters gathered for a third straight day Friday in front of the Elections Center in Phoenix, where hundreds of workers were processing and counting ballots. "Arrest the poll workers," the crowd chanted, demanding 4 more years in office for Trump. Sheriff's deputies kept protesters in a free speech zone away from the entrance to the building. "When we start auditing some of these voter rolls, their fraud may actually be exposed," conservative activist Charlie Kirk told the crowd, eliciting cheers. In Detroit, dozens of Trump supporters returned to the streets Friday outside the city's convention center, where election workers counted ballots. "Stop the steal," the protesters chanted. Some carried signs that read, "Make elections fair again," and "We love Trump." Police cordoned off streets leading to the building and maintained a close watch on the protest. The county treasurer in Detroit, Eric Sabri, said that he had closed office because of threats. In a statement, Sabri said the decision was made in the interest of the safety of taxpayers and our staff, and because of credible information from the sheriff's office. In October, Michigan's Secretary of State tried to ban the open carrying of weapons near polling stations and vote tallying centers, but the order is tied up in court. In Philadelphia, two men with handguns were arrested Thursday night near the convention center where one vote counting was going on. The men, ages 42 and 61, had driven up in a Hummer from Virginia and did not have permits to carry their weapons in Pennsylvania. Police said a military-style rifle and ammunition were found inside their vehicle, Police Commissioner Daniela Outlaw said. The car had a window sticker for the right-wing conspiracy theory QAnon. District Attorney Larry Krasner did not say why the men had come to Philadelphia, but said that there was no indications that they were part of an extremist group. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for November the 7th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Robert L. Duda. Robert L. Duda, 82, of Mason City, passed away Thursday, November 5th, 2020, at his home. The family plans to have a private day at the golf course in his honor in the future. Per his wishes, cremation has taken place and he will be buried in Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery at a later date. Robert Louis Duda was born July 1st, 1938, in Britt, Iowa, the son of Louis Joseph and Isabella Eleonora Duda. He attended McKinley Elementary and continued his education at Mason City High School, graduating in 1956. On November 21, 1959, Robert married the love of his life, Judith Jensen, in Mason City. The couple was blessed with three children. For many years, Bob worked at A.M. Skankey in Mason City, later working for the M.N. St. L. Railroad, Armor Decker, Borden's Ice Cream, and most recently at Winnebago, where he retired in 2006. Bob enjoyed hunting and spending time outdoors, something he enjoyed sharing with his family. The golf course was a special place for Bob, and many days were spent with friends and family there. Shirley A. Cabarilla. Shirley A. Cabarilla, 74, of 1026 North Taylor Avenue, Mason City, who died Thursday, November 5th, 2020, at Mercy One, Mason City. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 Tuesday, November 10th, 2020, at Epiphany Parish, Holy Family. Officiating will be Father Josh Link. Visitation will be from 5 until 8 p.m. Monday at Fullerton Funeral Home, 123 2nd Street Southeast. A parish rosary will be held at 7 p.m. followed by a vigil service. Interment will be in Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery. Masks and social distancing will be required during visitation and at the funeral. The funeral will also be live streamed from the church. Carol D. Sullivan. Carol Diane Sullivan passed away unexpectedly Wednesday, November 4th, 2020, in Mason City. A celebration of her life will be held 10 a.m. Friday, November 13th, 2020, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel. Carol will be laid to rest at Memorial Park Cemetery following the service. Visitation will be held from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Thursday, November 12th, 2020, at the funeral chapel. Masks will be required and social distancing requirements followed. Memorials may be directed to the family to be used to spread Carol's love for Christmas through Toys for Tots and other organizations. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast, Mason City, Iowa. Phone number is 641-432-2372. Now on to some sports. Let's start with the article, Cyclones Face Baylor Guarding Against November Swoon. Iowa State has reached that point in the season where the question becomes whether it can finish what it started. The 17th-ranked Cyclones are in a tie for the first time for first in the Big 12 and play three of their last four regular season games at home starting Saturday night against Baylor. Fifth-year coach Matt Campbell's teams have tended to struggle once the calendar turns to November. Last year, they saw three of their last five in the Big 12 play after a 3-1 start. After an embarrassing loss to Louisiana Lafayette in this year's opener, the season has been marked by the first win in over Oklahoma and Ames since 1960 and a three-point road loss to a top-10 Oklahoma State. The Cyclones bounced back from that with an easy win at Kansas last week, and now they take on a Baylor team that beat them 23-21 in Waco, Texas last year. Campbell said he likes the trajectory as his team tries to become one that gets better each week, not to mention making the Big 12 championship game for the first time. It takes time, it takes tradition, it takes leadership, Campbell said. It takes all those things to mold a standard of excellence through the entirety of a season. It's achievable, and sometimes we won't quit working towards it in our football program. Campbell acknowledged the disruption caused by the pandemic makes it much more difficult for a team to reach its potential. It takes everything to be aligned to do that, he said. We're talking about doing that with 18 to 20 year olds who have a zillion things going on, let alone in a year like this. What I'm asking is really hard. I get that and understand that. One thing Campbell said he hasn't done and won't do is talk to his team about playing for a conference championship, something that hasn't happened in Iowa State since 1912. Our kids understand from day one that I got here that we want to have the ability to compete at the highest level in this conference, he said. I think that's kind of understood what that looks and feels like. Baylor, not an easy out. The teams have split four meetings by a total of 29 points since Campbell arrived in Ames in 2016. The Bears have a four-year starter in quarterback Charlie Brewer, Big Ten's leading tackler and linebacker Terry Bernard, and talented transfers in linebacker Dylan Doyle and defensive end William Bradley King. I think this is one of the most talented teams we've played, Campbell said. When I look at Baylor, I look at a championship team, so we'll get their best shot, we know that. Fast start. Iowa State is 4-1 in the conference for the second time in program history. 2017 was the first. Cyclones have never been 5-1 in a league play since the program started in 1892. Brees is the word. Iowa State's Breece Hall is running for 150 yards per game to lead the nation among players with at least three games. The Cyclones are averaging 200 yards on the ground to rank first in the Big 12. Baylor is second to last in rushing defense. Now onto the article, Iowa's Run Game Lacking Consistency in 0-2 Start. Tyler Linderbaum has a lot of numbers floating around in his head these days. An 0-2 start to the Iowa football season in two games decided by a combined 5 points doesn't sit well with the Hawkeyes' sophomore center. He's even more flustered with the 77-yard encore the Iowa rushing attack endured a week ago following its 195-yard start at Purdue. It wasn't the kind of follow-up the Hawkeyes expected, and something that has become a focus as Iowa prepares for Saturday's 11 a.m. game at Kinnick Stadium against Michigan State. Once you get the run going, and if the defense can't stop it, they've got to get more guys in the box, so that definitely helps the team all the way around, Linderbaum said. If we do our jobs up front and set the tempo and get some yards in right away, good things happen. Hawkeye running backs averaged respectable 5.7 yards on 31 carries in the season opening, 24-20 loss to Purdue, but ran the ball just 18 times in last weekend's 21-20 loss to Northwestern, averaging 3.5 yards per carry. In general, Iowa as a good goal looks for the gains around 4.5 yards per rush. That dip in production against the Wildcats made a difference that not only led in part to Iowa putting the ball in the air 51 times, but has also had a hand in the Hawkeyes ranking 10th in the Big Ten in third down conversions, moving the chains on just 10 of 30 third downs snaps. We had a couple of good runs, hit a couple of them, but with consistency not enough, Fertinez said. We didn't run the ball effectively enough, and that's something we're going to have to get addressed because we don't want to play that way. Sophomore running back Tyler Goodson said he's prepared to do what it takes to help the Hawkeyes' ground game gain some traction. The first true freshman to ever lead the Iowa program in rushing yards a year ago continues to lead the team's rushing attack, gaining 120 yards on 29 carries. I could take as many carries as they give me, Goodson said. If they want me to go out and carry the ball 25, 30 times, I'll do it. He recognizes the value in that. Each week, the goal is to run the ball successfully, Goodson said. That's how every team goes into the game, and we need to be able to run the ball successfully at a good pace and constant rate, Goodson said. Northwestern has something to say about that a week ago, and Michigan State riding the momentum of a 27-24 game of 27-24 win at Michigan last week, expects to do the same. Like the Wildcats, the Spartans will fill the box with defenders. First-year coach Mel Tucker's team has utilized a 4-2-5 alignment built around bulk in the interior of its defensive front and the play of senior linebacker Antoine Simmons, one of four returning starters on the MSU defense. During a 1-1 start, Michigan State has limited its opponents to an average of 3.4 yards per carry. They play hard, come off the ball strong, Linderbaum said. We're just going to have to be on top of our game and be ready to go. Goodson includes himself in that equation, saying he needs to continue to work on his footwork in the backfield. He does see growth in his ability to read opposing linebackers, something facilitated in part by Iowa's use of a new Wildcat formation, which starts with a direct snap to its running back. We've been working on it since the start of practice, and I like it. It allows me to see how the defense is aligned in certain positions, said Goodson, who has the option to either carry the ball or run a read option play out of the look once he secures the snap. Fertinez said the Wildcat look was added to Iowa's offensive arsenal to best use the skill set of the Hawkeyes' personnel. Goodson wants it to be a productive option as the Hawkeyes attempt to earn their first win of the season. Saturday is very important. Being 0-2 is frustrating for the team, Goodson said. We want to do better, and we will do better. Now on to a more local news story, Globe Gazette's Fab Five running team. North Iowa's top 2020 cross-country standouts highlighted. The starting gun has been fired for the last time in 2020, and the running shoes sit in the corner, at least for the time being. With the state meet in the books, it is time to officially close the book on cross-country. There was plenty of bright spots this season, including Bryce McDonough running a personal record time at the state meet, Rachel Lair clinching West Hancock's first state meet appearance at the qualifying meet in Central Springs, and Lydia Mass blowing away the competition week after week. Now that the final race has been run, it's time for the Globe Gazette to name its Fab Five running team, made up of the top five boys and girls runners from area schools. Starting with the boys' Fab Five, Riley Witt of St. Ansgar. Witt didn't do as well as he was hoping at the state meet. He was hoping to finish in the top 10, but instead finished 23rd overall, with a time of 17 minutes, 23 seconds, and 0.9. But a tough ending doesn't take away from his spectacular season. Witt won 7 different races this season, including the state qualifying meet, where he ran a 16-minute and 36.71-second time. He ended the season as the number 6 runner in Iowa Class 1A and will be highly motivated to place well at the state in his senior season. Bryce McDonough, Central Springs. McDonough ran the race of his life on Saturday in Fort Dodge, finishing 14th overall with a time of 16 minutes and 59.1 seconds. The time was a personal record by 12 seconds, improved on his 2019 state meet by nearly a minute, and bumped him up 59 spots in the standings. McDonough was the Panthers' lone runner this year that went into the race with state experience and was the team's top finisher, with his twin brother Clayton next at 18 minutes and 12.2 seconds. Good for a 60th place. The Panthers finished 16th in their team standings for the day. Joey Hovinga, Forest City. After a strong team showing this season, Hovinga ended up being the lone Forest City boys runner to appear in Fort Dodge. Hovinga ran a new personal record with a time of 17 minutes and 23.4 seconds at state to finish 14th. He battled back from shin splints earlier in the year and moved up 34 spots from his 2019 time. He hopes that his senior year, he will be able to break the team record with a time of 15 minutes and 58 seconds. Justin Wright of Clear Lake. A four-time state qualifier, Wright finished 29th at state in 2020 and placed top four in six of his eight races this year. The Clear Lake senior improved on his state and finished as a junior. In 2019, Wright placed 67th at state, running a time of 17 minutes and 20.8 seconds. As the Lions' lone state runner, in 2020, Wright ran a 17 minute and 5.1 second. Wright, who was hospitalized before his freshman year after being hit by a car in Clear Lake, bounced back to turn himself into one of the area's elite athletes. Joey Ringo of Newman Catholic. Ringo ran with his team at the state meet for the second time in 2 years, and turned in a strong performance, finishing 52nd overall with a time of 18 minutes and 4.2 seconds. Ringo, a sophomore, qualified for the state meet with a fourth-place finish at the Central Springs qualifying meet and was the top runner on a Knights team that qualified for the state meet for the third consecutive year. Now for the girls' Fab Five. Kiki Connell of Charles City. Connell, who set a new school record at the 2020 state qualifying meet with a time of 17 minutes and 57.9 seconds, ran a time of 18 minutes and 54.1 seconds at the state meet to finish 4th overall. That improved on her 6th place finish a year ago. Connell is an extremely decorated Comets athlete. She placed 6th in state last year in her first season as a wrestler, was a member of the past two Charles City softball teams that made it to the state tournament, and qualified for the state meet in all 4 years of high school. Connell, who was good friends with former Charles City athlete Logan Luft, ended the season number 33 ranked runner in Class 3A, behind Peyton Noe and Shewayne Johnson of Bellard. Lydia Moss of Hampton Dumont Call. Moss became a freshman phenom this season for the Bulldogs. Before reaching the postseason, Moss would oftentimes finish several minutes ahead of her next closest competitor. She finished 5th overall at the state qualifying meet and placed 8th at the state final meet with a final time of 19 minutes and 14.1 seconds. For any runner, her accomplishments would have been impressive. For a freshman, they are staggering. Moss has 3 years to improve, and there is no limit to what she can accomplish in that time. Keep your eyes on Moss for the next few years. Caitlin Johnson of Osage. The Green Devils sophomore was the lone member of the school's cross-country team to make it to state this year, and moved up 15 spots in the field over her 2019 finish. Johnston finished 27th overall with a time of 21 minutes and 7.6 seconds, capping off a strong season in which she placed second at the top of Iowa East Championships. Abby Christians, Garner Hayfield Ventura. Christian's name is one that has been synonymous with cross-country success over the past 4 years. Christian's has won the individuals conference title twice in her high school career and was a four-time state qualifier. At Fort Dodge, Christian's placed 45th overall with a time of 21 minutes 37.4 seconds. Maggie McBride of Newman Catholic. McBride went from being the Knights' number 7 runner a year ago to being the team's top competitor in 2020. McBride placed 5th overall at the state qualifying meet in Manly, as the Knights won the race as a team to qualify for the state for the first time since 2017. McBride was also the Knights' top finisher at the state meet, with a 63rd place finish time of 21 minutes and 59.5 seconds, with senior Lily Stockberger close behind at 22 minutes 5.9 seconds. The Knights finished 14th overall as a team, with the school qualifying both squads for the state meet for the first time. Now let's finish off today with one more article that isn't related to sports. Let's do the article, Sunset School Plan Moves Ahead. Residents near Clear Lake Building Worried About Redevelopment. Residents near the former Sunset View Preschool property in Clear Lake are concerned about how it will be redeveloped and how it will affect their neighborhood. 6 property owners on Mars Hill Drive, Sunset View Drive, and Glen Cove Drive raised concerns about an increase in traffic, decreased future developments, increased traffic, increased parking, and increased property values Monday evening during a public hearing at City Hall. "We love our neighborhood, and we love our neighborhood and love our neighbors," said Leanne Murphy, who lived across the school property with her husband since 2016. "I think one of our biggest concerns is what's going to happen. We have a quiet little neighborhood right now." The public hearing was held for the proposed Sunset School Urban Revitalization Area Plan. An urban revitalization area allows the city to provide financial incentives like tax abatements to residential and commercial developers to encourage redevelopment and revitalization in a designated area under Iowa code. "We're trying to incentivize added housing opportunities," said Scott Flory, Clear Lake City Administrator. "I think anyone that has been around our community for any length of time or even new to the community can attest to the fact that housing is certainly a need in the community in a variety of types. The city's proposed urban revitalization area comprises the entire former Sunset View Preschool property at 408 Mars Hill Drive. The Clear Lake Community School District sold the property to Dolly James LLC in Cedar Falls in 2018 while it was constructing its new preschool attached to Clear Creek Elementary. The new preschool opened in the fall of 2019. According to the plan, eligible property improvements, including rehabilitation and additions to existing residential and commercial structures, as well as new construction that increases assessed property values by at least 10% and $10,000, would be eligible for tax abatements. The city agreed to support a 5-year 80% property tax abatement for the projects in the proposed area. Although Flory mentioned repeatedly that the city hadn't received plans for the redevelopment of the property, residents made it clear during the public hearing that they don't want to see anything that will change the tenure of where they live. Mars Hill and Sunset View Drives are looped communities off North Shore Drive, nestled between U.S. Highway 18 and Clear Lake, with a shuttered school in the center of them. Residents were walking their dogs and caring for their lawns in the neighborhood Friday morning. "My main concern is that if you look at this property from a bird's eye view, you will see that Sunset View Drive is a lazy-go-round. Mars Hills Drive, lazy-go-round. They're not through streets, so the amount of traffic that we can absorb is very important along with what would be the parking," said Bonnie Hall, who resides on Sunset View Drive. Deb Groth said that she's worried about how a future development will affect the property value of her home on Sunset View Drive. "I know that's a selfish attitude to go in with, but I'm a longtime community member and I love this community and I support pretty much everything it does, but I do think we need some additional information," she said. Mike Yore, who lives on Mars Hill Drive, questioned why the council was acting on the approval of an urban revitalization area plan when it was not clear what the future development of the property would entail. Mari Meyer, who resides on Glen Cove Drive and owns rental properties in the Sunset View Preschool property neighborhood, said she understands the need for more housing, especially affordable housing in Clear Lake, but she wanted clarification on the process and on what the city's expectations were for the property. I've been following this saga for a while, and as of now, I see nothing concrete about what is planned for there, so that matters to me, she said. Clear Lake School Superintendent Doug Gee said there has been a desperate need for housing within the city and that the need will likely grow in the years to come as the district attracts more families to the community. The district's open enrollment, or the number of children who have come from another district to attend Clear Lake schools, grew by 50% this year, and within the last 4 years, it's grown by 110, he said. Clear Lake served enrollment has grown by 81 students within the past 2 years, and Gee expects that it would be more if families could find affordable housing in the district. That is one of the reasons we sold that property, was the hopes that they would build some housing there and some housing there of the sort that would help us, he said. Flory said the approval of the Sunset School Urban Revitalization Area Plan doesn't change the property's zoning, which is currently public. A rezoning request would have to be reviewed by the Clear Lake Planning and Zoning Commission, and then City Council would hold a public hearing before a change is made. He said the Urban Revitalization Plan is the first step towards future redevelopment of at the property. After the public hearing, the Clear Lake City Council unanimously approved a resolution adopting the Sunset School Urban Revitalization Plan and an ordinance designating the area of Clear Lake as the 2020 Sunset School Urban Revitalization Area. Clear Lake, like many communities, has a long history of having to repurpose property for the needs for new needs as the needs of the community change. And I think this is possible where this is possibly where we might be headed with this, said Mike Collinan, Clear Lake City Councilman. Mayor Nelson Crabb and council members Bennett Smith and Collinan assured the residents that the council would take in their concerns into consideration when and if things progress at the old school property. The council will have its second and third readings of the ordinance at the meeting on November 16th and December 7th, respectively. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for November the 7th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.